You're listening to the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast, bringing you compelling true crime stories from the Appalachian Mountains and beyond. I'm your host, Alfred Dockery. Grab your hat and the lantern, and let's get on the trail. The Little Dillingers of East Tennessee. A Newport jailbreak leads to deadly consequences down the road. You've heard of Depression-era gangsters like John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, and Pretty Boy Floyd, but did you know that East Tennessee had two of its own? Clarence P. Jim Bunch and Gus McCoy were two homegrown highwaymen and bank robbers whose exploits caused outrage and fear throughout the region. Both men would have short, colorful, and violent careers. The story begins in late February 1934, when the Knoxville police conducted a liquor raid on Charlie Epperson's house on Lay Avenue. They arrested Epperson and 23-year-old Clarence Bunch. This wasn't the pair's first liquor-related arrest. Epperson, Bunch, and a man named Fletcher Giles were arrested in Knoxville in March of 1933 for felonious assault with intent to commit murder for firing on two revenue agents who were pursuing them. A Knox County grand jury declined to indict them, but the trio was found guilty on federal charges for hauling liquor. Epperson was sentenced to 3 years and a $1,000 fine. Bunch and Giles got 15 months. Their lawyer filed an appeal, and the repeal of national prohibition got them off the hook. Both men were transferred to the Cotton County Jail in Newport. They were wanted there for stealing a car. To really visualize the places we're talking about today, head over to the Blue Ridge True Crime Substack. I've created a companion post for this episode with maps of East Tennessee, relevant images, and all of my sources. It'll give you a much clearer picture of the landscape. Click the link in the show notes. While Bunch was cooling his heels in the county lockup, he was indicted for his part in robbing the People's Bank of Ewing, Virginia in January, and Virginia started extradition proceedings. Two of his confederates had been tracked down by Sheriff Giles of Lee County and had pled guilty. Both men received a 45-year sentence. Bunch had been the wheelman sitting outside in the getaway car with a submachine gun while the other three robbed the bank of $6,300, about $150,000 today. Anyway you slice it, Bunch's year was off to a rocky start. Escape from Cotton County. At the Newport jail, Bunch met Gus McCoy, who was charged with forgery. The two became fast friends. Rather than take their chances with the court, the duo opted for Plan B, a jailbreak. On the morning of Tuesday, May 15th, Bunch, McCoy, and another inmate, John Campbell, were mopping their cell. They called for their jailer, O.J. Melton, to come and get the mop. As the jailer opened the door, Bunch drew a .38 caliber pistol and ordered him to stand back. There was a brief scuffle, and Bunch shot Melton in the arm. They took Melton's keys, locked him and three others in their cell, and walked out. The jailer was the only person on duty that morning. The men carjacked a Ford V8 and headed for Asheville. Unfortunately for them, the car only had about a gallon of gas. They abandoned the vehicle on a side road off Old Asheville Highway, about 5 miles from Newport. The trio fled into the woods, and despite a reported 100 men searching for them and having two bloodhounds put on their trail, they made good their escape. This was the first time Bunch eluded capture on foot. It would not be the last. Investigators later discovered a blanket in the cell had been cut and twisted into a makeshift rope. They believed Bunch used it to pull a gun up into his cell from the outside. Bunch's girlfriend, Nell Payne, had recently visited him in jail, and she was suspected of providing the gun. She denied the charge. The front page of the Knoxville News Sentinel carried an item about the jailbreak with the headline, "Shoot Way Out of Cock Jail." It was continued on the last page of the paper, which had a photo of Bunch with a caption that read, "East Tennessee's Dillinger." It may have been a reference to John Dillinger's escape from the Lake County Jail in Crown Point, Indiana, 2 months earlier. Dillinger surprised guards with a fake gun carved from wood and blacked with shoe polish and forced them to open the door to his cell. Fun fact, whether Dillinger escaped using a fake gun or a real gun remains somewhat controversial. Summer of Mayhem. On July 9, the Citizens Bank of White Pine was robbed by four men with submachine guns. $2,000 was taken. Bunch and McCoy were suspected of being involved. By mid-July, a pair of bandits was reported to have robbed several black men in a truck, a New York tourist, and two North Carolina men on the highway near Bean Station. A service station in the vicinity was also robbed. Police suspected Bunch and McCoy. The Jefferson County Sheriff's Department had staked out the home of McCoy's father about a mile south of White Pine. On Saturday, July 21st, they caught McCoy coming out and opened fire on him, Bunch, and a third man. In the gun battle, 50 to 60 rounds were exchanged. The trio jumped into a black Ford coupe and escaped. The pot boiled over on Sunday, July 29th. That evening, Bunch, McCoy, and Charles Bounds robbed 11 cars near Leah Springs. They chased one car for a mile and caught it by shooting out one of its tires. They robbed the couple in the car. When other cars stopped, they forced the occupants out onto the roadside and robbed them as well. In addition to cash, the gang reportedly also took watches, a poll tax receipt, and in one case, some small chains. Sheriff J. Wesley Brewer of Knox County caught up with the gang Monday morning at Bob Holt's tourist camp on Rutledge Pike. They were pulling out as the sheriff pulled in, and the gang's Ford V8 quickly outdistanced the police vehicle. The bandit car whizzed past, and the sheriff recognized Bunch and McCoy. The third man was a stranger to him. After they left Knoxville, they stopped and robbed a businessman near Dandridge around noon, taking $66, his watch, a ring, and his fountain pen. The gang then robbed a nearby store owned by Arthur Breeden. There, in addition to robbing a dozen customers, they took a shotgun and a large supply of ammunition. Jefferson County Sheriff S.B. Churchman received a phone call alerting him to the robbery in progress and sped to the scene with two deputies. They got there as the bandits were leaving and found themselves in a rolling shootout. Bunch and company saw them coming, hopped in their car, and raced toward the police vehicle, firing on it as they closed the distance. The officers returned fire. According to Churchman, the officers shot out the windshield of the bandit car as they passed, then turned and gave chase for about a mile, shooting out the rear windshield as well. The sheriff's car was hit four times, but none of the officers were injured. The Tuesday, July 31st, Knoxville Journal carried the following headline: Bandits Terrorize Section. Shoot way past traps laid by officers of six counties. The opening paragraph read, "Their guns blazing, grim and deadly defiance to officers of half a dozen counties, a trio of the boldest gangsters in East Tennessee crime annals shot their way to freedom several times yesterday and were late last night reported to be afoot in the Caney Valley in Claiborne County." Multiple newspapers referred to Bunch as East Tennessee's public enemy number one. Motorists begin to go armed. The guns of August. On the morning of August 7th, a posse made up of a Claiborne County deputy and four policemen from Middleton, Kentucky, captured McCoy at a mountain hideout near Tazewell and placed him in the Claiborne County jail under heavy guard. Weak from loss of blood due to a gunshot wound to his right leg, injuries from an overturned car, and just plain exhaustion, McCoy offered no resistance. He had been hit when the gang fled Bob Holt's filling station in Knox County, with officers in pursuit. The other three gang members, Bunch, Charlie Bounds, and Good Aubrey, were still at large. Having gotten Tennessee law enforcement's undivided attention, Bunch realized it was only a matter of time before he was under arrest or underground. Beginning on Monday, August 20th, he made numerous telephone calls to Knox County Sheriff Brewer to negotiate his surrender. According to the Knoxville News Sentinel, Bunch also called state officers, lawyers, and a deputy U.S. Marshal. Clearly, he was looking for the best deal he could get. According to the Knoxville News Sentinel, Bunch told Brewer, "It's either the graveyard or the penitentiary for me. I'll take the penitentiary." On the afternoon of Wednesday, August 27th, Sheriff Brewer traced the call to Charlie Emerson's house on Lay Avenue and decided to end the haggling by simply arresting Bunch. He ordered deputies to quietly surround the house. Three Knoxville police officers were the first on the scene, Officers Carl Bunch, J.C. Franklin, and W.H. Gregg. Bunch was Clarence Bunch's second cousin. Small world. They were there to arrest Charlie Epperson for an outstanding warrant. They were surprised to encounter Clarence Bunch, Granger County Sheriff Sam Roach, and his chief deputy, H.C. Van. They were told that Roach and Van were trying to negotiate a settlement for Bunch. The entire party walked down to the street. Sheriff Brewer and Chief Deputy Tom Kirby drove up, and the concealed Knox County deputies swarmed in from all directions. There was a brief, tense standoff. Then things went south. Kirby asked Roach to produce his arrest warrants. Roach fumbled through his pockets but couldn't find them. He did actually have two arrest warrants issued by the Granger County Clerk of Court 10 days prior. Kirby then ordered officers to take Sheriff Roach's gun. Bunch shouted, "Like hell." There are multiple versions of what happened next from the sheriff, police officers, reporters, and bystanders. Any of them might be true. The consensus seems to be that Bunch grabbed a pistol from Sheriff Roach, ran about 20 feet, and turned. Sheriff Brewer said Bunch got off a single shot before deputies opened fire on him. The Knoxville police officer said he leveled the gun at the crowd, but was shot before he could fire. Regardless, the police opened up, including Kirby, who was armed with a submachine gun. Bunch was hit 27 times. Brewer stood over the outlaw's body as it lay in the dirt in front of the road. Bunch muttered something. The sheriff bent close and said, "What's that, Clarence?" A gurgling sound was the only reply. Blood poured onto the road, turning the dirt to mud. Clarence Bunch was dead at the age of 23. Sheriff Brewer arrested Roach and charged him with aiding and abetting a fugitive. In December 1935, both Sheriff Roach and Epperson's wife, Patra, were found guilty of conspiring to help Bunch evade the law. Charlie Epperson wasn't at the trial. He was in prison for robbing the Tennessee Biscuit Company. Busy guy. A crowd estimated at more than 10,000 people lined up at the funeral home to see the body. The next day, the Knoxville Journal ran a photo of Bunch's body on its front page. The caption above the photo read, "Bunch beats payoff. The wages of sin is death." On November 22nd, Gus McCoy and Charlie Bounds were sentenced to 30 years each for two counts of highway robbery. The two pled guilty to robbing J.A. Reedon's store and Will Schrader on the highway during the long chase of July 30. And that was the end of the Bunch gang, but not the end of their story. Nashville to Tazewell. On December 3, 1935, Gus McCoy and two other convicts, Pete Dean and George Moss, escaped from the Tennessee Penitentiary in Nashville. Deputy Warden Ed Connors drove back into the prison after having lunch at home and parked across from the prison hosiery mill. The three prisoners, who were mechanics in the mill, caught Connors as he was getting out of his car. Dean produced a knife and forced Connors back into the front seat. McCoy got in on the passenger side, shoved a gun into his side, and threatened to blow him in half if he didn't convince the guard to open the gate. Moss got in the back. Dean drove. They dropped off the warden about 2 miles from the prison. One of them gave him a dime to ride the streetcar back. The car was found in Spring Hill that night, and a vehicle belonging to Dr. B.H. Woodard went missing. As with John Dillinger's escape, people still debate whether McCoy's gun was real or fake. Authorities believe the men were headed for Memphis. Knox County Sheriff Brewer predicted that McCoy would head back to East Tennessee. They wouldn't have to debate the fugitive's whereabouts for long. On the night of December 5th, Union County Deputy Sheriff Bob Hatfield was investigating a suspicious car parked on the roadside and captured George Moss near Tazewell after a fierce hand-to-hand struggle. McCoy and Dean scrambled back to the car and fled. The deputy said he had to hit Moss over the head several times before he finally got him in the car. About 2 miles outside Tazewell, Moss grabbed the steering wheel, sending the car into a ditch. Deputy Hatfield flagged down another car and took Moss to jail. That deputy was a bulldog. The next day, a posse began searching for them near the Kentucky-Tennessee line. You would think that after being spotted, the fugitives would try to get as far away as possible. That's what you get for thinking. A bridge too far. On the morning of December 6th, three men robbed the Citizens Bank of New Tazewell. McCoy, Dean, and Frank Hobson, who joined them the day before. They got away with $2,600, about $62,000 today. Union County Sheriff Louis B. Hutchinson received word by phone that the bank robbers were headed south on Highway 33 toward Maynardville. The sheriff and an auto mechanic and special deputy, Austin Matthews, headed north to intercept them. About a mile north of the Clinch River Bridge, they spotted the yellow coupe they were looking for, headed southbound, and turned to chase it. The car stopped on the bridge, and two men got out and started shooting at them. Matthews said McCoy fired the first shot, shattering the car's window, after which the sheriff stood and yelled, "Wait a minute, boys!" McCoy then fired again, striking Hutchinson in the forehead. Matthews also stated that he and the sheriff had each fired only one shot, and that after Hutchinson was shot, he, Matthews, threw his gun toward the gunman and surrendered. A Greyhound bus drove up just as the fight ended. The bandits walked Matthews behind the bus, returned to their car, and drove off. Matthews loaded the wounded sheriff into the car and headed for Maynardville at top speed. Hutchinson was rushed to General Hospital in Knoxville. He died later that afternoon. Back in Maynardville, Matthews inspected the car and found it had 7 bullet holes, 5 in the radiator, 1 in the fender, and the one that smashed the window. Frank Hobson surrendered to police at his family's home near Tazewell on December 7th. Pete Dean was captured on February 7th near Gainesboro after committing another bank robbery. A day later, it was McCoy's turn. He was captured at a cabin in a tourist camp near Crossville. Officers quietly surrounded a cabin at the Dykes Tourist Camp. McCoy had arrived the night before and parked his car out of sight behind a cabin. He told camp owner T.F. Dykes he was hiding the car from his brother-in-law. Dykes became suspicious and called Cumberland County Sheriff Walter Hill. Sheriff Hill, two deputies, and the newly deputized Dykes approached the cabin. Dykes got McCoy to open the door. Deputy Will Adams instructed the fugitive to "get your hands up right where you are." McCoy turned white and put up his hands. A contentious trial. McCoy, Hobson, and Dean were tried for the murder of Sheriff Hutchinson in Maynardville. The 4-day trial was packed. The prosecution went hard for the death penalty. Assistant counsel Hal Clements stated that the defendants must all boil in the same pot. Attorney General J.W. Wolfenbarger said, "Give each one of them the chair. An eye for an eye came up more than once." Bus driver Percy Tevis identified McCoy and Hobson as the two men shooting at Hutchinson and Matthews. Matthews testified that he saw McCoy shoot twice, that the first bullet went through the window in the car door, and that the second hit the late sheriff in the head. He also said Dean was at the wheel of the coupe during the shootout and did not participate. Law enforcement officers testified that Dean and Hobson had told them that McCoy fired the shot that killed Sheriff Hutchinson. McCoy said he was drunk during the shootout and didn't know if he shot Hutchinson or not. On February 29, 1936, all three men were found guilty of first-degree murder and sentenced to die in the Tennessee electric chair. A year later, Governor Gordon Browne commuted the death sentence for Dean and Hobson to life in prison. He declined to interfere with the execution of McCoy. On April 8, 1937, McCoy walked the 20 paces from his cell to the electric chair with his head held high and said he was not afraid to die. At 5:22 a.m., a charge of electricity was sent through his body. He was pronounced dead a minute and a half later. He was 25 years old. Epilogue. It's hard to make sense of the Bunch Gang's wild 300-mile chase and their 1934 crime wave. As for Gus McCoy and his brief 1935 spree, I'm not sure whether to describe him as a repeat offender or a slow learner. You would think that Bunch's fate would have set him on a less destructive path. I can't help but think that their crimes were in part a product of the Great Depression. It was a hopeless, jaded era where mere survival was its own struggle. In the opening, I mentioned John Dillinger, Babyface Nelson, and Pretty Boy Floyd. 1934 wasn't just a year. It was a reaper for gangsters. Dillinger died at 31 on July 22nd, Nelson at 25 on November 27th, and Floyd at 30 on October 22nd. For that matter, Bonnie Parker and Clyde Barrow cashed in on May 23rd. She was 23, and he was 25. All shared the same cause of death as Bunch, gunshot wounds. They were chasing money and recognition, and perhaps an escape from the grinding monotony of their lives. Their personal struggles didn't excuse their crimes or make whole the people they harmed. Perhaps the most disturbing part of their stories is that they saw they were speeding toward a cliff, yet were utterly unable to swerve or brake. That's it for this episode of the Blue Ridge True Crime Podcast. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please hit subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps more people find the show. Check the show notes for links to the Blue Ridge True Crime Substack and YouTube channel, and any story-related links. Until next time, I'll look for you on the back roads. Thank you.